And good morning to you. Welcome to Life Matters on ABCRN. Natasha Mitchell joining you. Thanks for tuning in as your morning with us takes flight. And we're taking flight with Melbourne-born, London-based music critic Jane Cornwell today.
At this time, I went while the Goat Festival was on, and this is a very bacchanalian pagan festival that goes way back into sort of the mists of time, and it's about men dressing up as goats, basically. So they would wear the skin or the carcasses of kids, you know, baby goats, and they cover themselves in bells, and it's quite a spectacle when you've got the whole community dressed up as goats, and it goes for a week, and it's a bit like the Wicker Man, you know, you expect to see Edward Woodward trapped in a giant burning effigy or something at some point.
Suddenly, you know? Johnny gets a feeling he's been surrounded by.
Yes, it all started for Jane Cornwell in her Melbourne bedroom listening to Patti Smith, the great, great Patti Smith in the 1970s. Music critic Jane Cornwell, and reading about her life, it all makes sense why she's called her memoir The Whirl, Men, Music and Misadventures. She's joining us later. And of course, Patti Smith, muse to so many. Well, we're going to meet on the program today a group of artists for whom pain is their muse, as in physical pain. It's a curious collaboration between artists and pain scientists, making the invisible visible in intriguing ways. So stick around for that, really interesting. Now, yesterday we spoke to Dr. Russell Shuttleworth, who you might recall is developing guidelines and doing research to better enable people with physical disabilities to receive support to express themselves sexually. It's tricky terrain, it's vital terrain, but it had one support worker concerned. Here's a call.
Hello, I'm listening to Life Matters and Sex Workers for Disability. It's a very dangerous area here in Australia. I've been a support worker for a long time, and we do facilitate, but it has to be reported and taken up by the management. This gentleman seems to propagate the fact that you can just do it off your own back, especially with the amount of people that have been abused within disability. There has to be some very ethical guidelines, which we do have here, but quite a disturbing interview, I think. All right, thank you. Bye-bye.
And thank you for your call. And our clear impression from reading Dr. Russell Shuttleworth's research is that it is very much directed at informing better, clearer guidelines for people and their carers when it comes to enabling people to express themselves sexually when they need support to do that. And the distinction was made very clear between facilitated sex and sexual expression and sex work, which is a different kettle of fish. And Megan on Facebook writes, loved that discussion. Must be so difficult to not be able to have sexual experiences yourself. And I think it's wonderful if people are able to talk to fellow humans and help them to have the most beautiful feelings in the world they so rightly deserve. So please get in touch on anything that you're hearing. Share any view that you've got. Our listener feedback line to record your message is 02 833 1430, or tweet us at RN Life Matters, or go down our website and contact us that way. And I know music critic Jane Cornwell probably pushed the boundaries when she was a teenager, but not into the criminal realm. And certainly when you push boundaries as a teen, sometimes it's beyond the bounds of the law: vandalism, drug use, shoplifting. Now, for many teens, that's where their offending careers end, comparatively petty offences. Others can escalate into more serious offences, for example, crimes of violence. What pulls one kid back from the brink while another catapults and continues along a more dangerous and damaging path? American researcher Del Elliott is a leader in this field. He's the founding director of the Center for the Study and Prevention of Violence at the University of Colorado. He's written a host of compelling books with titles like Multiple Problem Youth Delinquency, Violence in American Schools, Good Kids from Bad Neighbourhoods. He's in Brisbane at the moment for a youth violence conference hosted by Griffith University, and he joins us in the Brizzy studios this morning. Good morning to you, Del.
Good morning.
In the US, I guess there is an impression that easy access to guns has made violence by teens deadly, absolutely deadly. But are the underlying causes of teen violence similar everywhere?
Well, that's a great question. I think that, first of all, there are multiple causal paths that lead one into violent behavior. And my guess is that some of those paths are very common across all cultures. There may be some paths which are unique to particular environmental conditions you might find one place and not in another.
What's the core work of your center? What's its mandate?
The mandate is primarily to do research, which delves into the question of what causes individuals to get caught up in violent behavior and what kinds of conditions and factors lead them to get out of it and to desist their violence. And we have what's called the Blueprints for Positive Youth Development, a project in which we review all of the evidence around prevention programs, violence prevention, drug prevention programs, and we certify which programs have high levels of scientific evidence for their effectiveness, and then we promote those programs.
And that's vital, isn't it? Because so much public money gets poured in different directions without clarity of purpose and clarity of understanding as to whether it's the best use of funds to support children who are vulnerable.
That's absolutely correct. It's unfortunate that we are most of the programs in this area dealing with kids who are violent or caught up in drugs and delinquency. Most of the programs which we're implementing in the U.S. have no credible evidence for their effectiveness.
No credible evidence at all.
At all.
Goodness me. Let's enter high schools because they disturbingly have been, the high school community has been a target for some of the most devastating violence by teenagers. Is the fact that kids are bullied at school or isolated as a loner, that's often mentioned as a trigger for a violent reaction. But really, how strong a factor is that?
Well, it is one risk factor, as we would call it, that it is one condition that is a part of a cluster of conditions, really, that leads one to cross that boundary, which I think you aptly described in the beginning, cross that boundary between, petty kinds of things and into really serious kinds of criminal behavior. But it really takes more than that. That is, it's unusual for a person, if that's the only negative experience or the only kind of involvement in aggressive behavior that's involved, it's unlikely that that by itself would be sufficient to trigger someone into serious kinds of violent behavior, into aggravated assaults or robberies or rapes or homicide.
People point to bad neighbourhoods, and you've written a book, Good Kids from Bad Neighbourhoods. Bad neighbourhoods, so-called, get blamed for being incubators of criminal or violent activity by kids and teens. Is that a vital factor? Is that primarily, is that more important than parents, for example?
Oh, that it's not nearly as important as parents. Mm. We have two different basic onset trajectories into serious violence, and one of them is what we call a life course persistent pattern, which begins very, very early. And in that pattern and that trajectory which leads to violence, the critical issues are the quality of caregiving in the home and certain personality traits and characteristics that children have genetically. So that would deal with persons who are aggressive, naturally assertive and aggressive. But you put that kind of a person in an environment where there's very poor quality caregiving, where there's abuse, where there's exposure to violence, where there's exposure to drug use, and all of those characteristics. And that creates an environmental condition in which kids grow up seeing violence and seeing that violence is functional, that it helps control certain kinds of situations, and that sets them on a path which, if we don't intervene and help them, then what we know is that that's likely to be a life course characteristic throughout all of their adolescence and into their adult years.
Dale Elliott, that very much interests me, that notion of control as being a contributing factor, that seeking of control as a contributing factor for children to escalate into a kind of pathway of violence, that violence itself becomes a way of exercising control when they have none in most other domains of their life.
I think that's absolutely correct. And if you don't have alternative ways of dealing with problems and issues which you confront, then violence remains one of those issues. But it is important to say that, you know, children who grow up in a situation, for example, where there's domestic violence going on the part of their parents and other members of their family, children learn to respond to that in multiple ways. Mm. That is, some children see that and see the negative consequences of it and the harm that it does and the way that it destroys relationships, and they learn that it has very negative consequences, and they actually come out of that kind of a situation trying to avoid violence in every way they can. Others see that it works to control the behavior of another. It works to achieve what you want, to get what you want. And what they've learned from it is that that's a strategy they can use to deal with their problems.
It depends on the individual child and their response.
It does.
What's protective then? What determines whether one teenager takes either path? Is it primarily temperament or peer group?
Well, both of those are involved. That is, the path into serious violence involves typically both environmental conditions and personality traits, and quite frankly, the level of commitment that a child develops in early childhood to moral, conventional, positive kinds of behavior. But there is a trigger that is typical for most of those who will enter into violent behavior. And that trigger has to do with becoming involved and associating with other kids who have similar kinds of problems, and that there is kind of a group-level solution that involves their becoming involved in serious kinds of criminal behavior, including violence and drug use, and other kinds of more serious offending behavior. So what we know is that that seems to be a factor which is common in all of these different causal paths that lead into serious crime.
Professor Del Elliott, who's joining us today, he is the founding director of the Center for the Study and Prevention of Violence at the University of Colorado. He's in Australia for a conference looking at youth violence, hosted by Griffith University. Looking then at teenagers, as you have so closely, who then subsequently become adult offenders, is there a key moment to intervene in that trajectory? Is that being too reductionist?
Well, I'm not sure it's been too reductionist. The issue is that violence, the onset of violence, happens almost totally within the second decade of life. So that suggests to us that our interventions have to be in early childhood and early adolescence. Because by the time a person reaches the age of 20, if they've not initiated violence yet in their lives, they are very unlikely to ever become violent. So if we're going to intervene before one gets caught up in violence, it's going to have to be in early childhood or early adolescence. There, in addition to that, that causal path I described earlier, there's a second causal path in which the causal factors do not appear until after the onset of puberty. So these are problems which are related not to how children are doing with parents and in the family, but as they make the transition into adolescence, how they do with other adolescents, whether they're liked, whether they're not liked. If, as you probably can remember, at that age, being liked by other kids becomes a very critical kind of issue. So there are a whole new set of social demands, new skills which have to be acquired and developed that deal primarily with my relationship with other peers, how I'm doing in school, what's going on in my neighborhood, because I am now, you know, actively roaming around through the neighborhood and exposed to what's going on in the neighborhood. And that late, what we call late onset pattern, involves kids who may not have any problems during childhood. So
it's every parent's greatest fear, that particular transition. And I know a lot of parents with children at that age, and they kind of have nightmares about it. So let's look then, on the basis of all this work that you do with the Blueprints for Healthy Youth Development Project, where you're reviewing evidence across the board of interventions that really do work, for which there's the greatest evidence. For early childhood, what factors need to be put in place? And for those teens who are discovering this path as they're entering teenhood, what needs to be put in place? What have you seen really work?
The early childhood interventions that work are primarily parent effectiveness training programs. And these are programs working with parents, teaching them how to provide for a healthier social environment there at home, a home in which there is a loving relationship, and yet there's monitoring and supervision of behavior, where the parents are actively participating in that child's world, particularly as we move into early adolescence, and what's happening with respect to the peer groups that they're involved in and how they're doing in school and other kinds of issues. So we're back to that quality of caregiving as being the primary problem for that early onset pattern. And we address that by helping parents, teaching them how they can be more effective as parents in raising their children.
So if a child does enter a gang, say, and that peer group kind of sucks them away from the family dynamic, and that's where things can go astray, what can parents do in that situation? Because that's quite terrifying.
Yeah. And early, they can do quite a bit. After a child reaches 14 or 15 and has that problem, parents really don't have as much power or as much control over that. So that the parent intervention for those kinds of issues has to take place earlier. Once that's happened, then we have a different set of programs which are available to help adolescents deal with that kind of problem. So we have programs on our Blueprints list, which are early childhood interventions, and we have programs which are early adolescent interventions. The adolescent interventions are ones which are more complex because they have to deal with what's going on at school. So bullying prevention programs, for example, would be dealing with one dimension of that. They have to be dealing with what's going on in a neighborhood. They have to include, to some extent, what's going on in the family, although that's not nearly as critical now as it was for earlier in the life course.
It's very interesting research that you do, and it's great to have the opportunity to talk to you on Life Matters this morning. Dale Elliott, thank you very much for joining us.
You're welcome. Thank you.
And Professor Dale Elliott, founding director of the Center for the Study and Prevention of Violence at the University of Colorado. And there's a website dedicated to their Blueprint program, and we'll try and add that to ours. Very interesting work indeed. Well, Life Matters is where you are. The art of pain. Yes, next. You know, pain is weird. Sometimes it's indescribable. It can often be debilitating. And pain specialists have ways of helping us rate our pain and its impact through all sorts of questionnaires and other tools. But one of the difficulties, of course, is that the experience of pain is so internal and individual and subjective. Now, what if artists and pain scientists got together to develop a new kind of language to describe the experience, to render the invisible visible in some way? The Art of Pain is the name of an exhibition and a series of lectures and events in Adelaide this week. It launched last night, born out of a unique collaboration between artists and scientists. And Eugenie Lee and Kat Jones, as artists, were both recipients of what's called the Synapse art science residencies through the Australian Network of Art and Technology. Leading pain researcher Professor Lorimer Moseley is the head of the Body in Mind Research Group at the University of South Australia. Well, his lab hosted Eugenie and Kat in their separate residencies, and they all join me on Life Matters this morning from our Adelaide studios. Good morning to you.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Got you
there.
Lorimer, as a pain scientist, why were you willing to open your lab up to a couple of artists?
Oh, you make it sound like pain scientists would be unwilling for that, Natasha. Look, I jumped at that opportunity. I guess one of the most frustrating things working in the pain field is that you're working with something that is not homogenous. It's ubiquitous, but it's not homogenous, and everyone feels their own pain, but no one feels anyone else's. So the challenge that we have trying to study and understand pain is getting insight into what it feels like. And it's difficult to communicate that. And I guess ultimately you can see whenever anyone's trying to get their message of pain across, they have to use metaphors or try to demonstrate how bad it is by describing an injury. You know, it's bone on bone in there or something like that. And that's not describing the pain. It's just trying to get across the enormity of the feeling. So the idea of having an artist sit with us and understand what we try to understand and then use a whole skill set and resource set that we don't have to communicate about that was really exciting for me.
Eugenie Lee, chronic pain has been a big part of your life and indeed your art for decades. Where did it all begin for you?
It actually started when I was a teenager, but I didn't realise that was part of this beginning of my chronic pain journey. And then it just sort of gradually got worse. And when it actually really, really affected my life day-to-day basis, I decided to turn that into an art form. And in a way, I actually had no choice but turn it into an artwork because the pain was extremely consuming that I couldn't think of any other way to deal with pain. So it was just very natural progress.
Because the medical profession for many years didn't have an adequate explanation and you had to go, in a sense, seeking your own explanations in a creative way.
Yeah, it wasn't really intentional. It just sort of happened naturally. And I actually couldn't understand there was a link between bodily pain and also all the confusion and misunderstanding and all psychological pain that went along with it. I just didn't think there was a connection between it. So initially I started working into looking at the psychological pain, and then later on I realized there was no separation between the bodily and psychological and social pain.
And you do paintings and sculptures and installations and I mean, you often appear in your works, not all of them, but there's a representation of a woman who must be you, and it's a very kind of lonely and frightening sort of image often, is that? And confined. And I wonder whether they're the scenes that you think most represent your experience of pain.
Yes. Even when I think about it, like many years ago when I started those paintings, it sort of draws tears into my eyes because it has been very, very lonely and nobody could really understand what I was going through and I couldn't really explain it either because I couldn't actually find words to describe what I was feeling, but yeah, it's just extremely personal images.
And in fact, they eventually did give you a name for what was going on, and it was endometriosis. But that took until your 20s. Did that make any difference, even just having a name to describe what you were dealing with?
Yeah, actually, I was extremely glad when my gynecologist said, "I think you have endometriosis." And I said, "Thank goodness," because that actually gave me a sense of control in a way to what I was experiencing. And I'm a strong believer of giving some kind of sense of control to the patients, because once they have, it feels like you're getting your life back in certain ways and you're almost like halfway there to get better.
Yeah, your work is very interesting because you explore this mismatch between your personal experience of pain and medical descriptions of what you're experiencing. There's an incredible sculpture that you've done, which is based on one of the very well-known pain questionnaires that clinicians use to put words to the experience. And in fact, you've got this sort of filing cabinet with some of the words that appear in that pain questionnaire, but right through the heart of the cabinet is this sort of roll of rotating barbed wire. What are you playing with there?
Well, McGill Pain Questionnaire, when I first discovered this questionnaire, I was extremely excited because I thought, wow, there are scientists out there who actually looked into the subjective side of the patient's experience in pain. And I thought I had to do something about this, and I really, really wanted to make an artwork. And I also wanted to know what my artwork would look like if I combine an objective clinical method with what is essentially a very subjective experience. And I thought filing cabinet would be the best form to describe what I would with my intention, because filing cabinet is for keeping order of, you know, one's admin materials and to organize everything into a systematic manner. And with the questionnaires, it's almost like keeping order of one's pain experience, and it's a way of expressing the way what the medical science tries to administer.
But it's a very disorderly experience, pain, and you describe it as those strings of barbed wire are scraping against my organs, hence the barbed wire.
You know, the McGill Pain Questionnaire follows the adjectives that patients use when they describe their pain, and they use metaphor. So if somebody said it feels like somebody's digging into my organs with a barbed wire, which is my, that's how I would use with my metaphorical expression for my pain, I just had to put that into the visual representation, visual manifestation. And, yeah, that's what I did.
Lorimer, how do you respond to a work like that as a pain scientist, a pain researcher?
Well, Eugenie came away with us on our research for group retreat last year and gave us a bit of a talk. And there were 30 scientists in the room listening to Eugenie, and we were all gobsmacked. I think there was probably 30% tear rate, and the rest of us were silenced by it. I think it's very profound for a scientist to understand anything new about the lived experience of pain, because this is what we're really passionate about, understanding this and improving the lot of 20% of humans who have some sort of disabling pain. But when you're studying something like pain, you're invariably on the outside looking in. Even for scientists who suffer pain themselves, they almost have two roles. So it's a beautiful and empowering situation for us as the explorers in the intellectual space to get insight. And we got a huge dose of insight in our experiences with Eugenia and with Kat, actually.
Yes, let me come to Kat. You're a writer and a performer and a photographer and a media artist. Why were you interested in landing in the heart of a chronic pain research lab?
Well, the work I've been making is using a methodology of illusions that is actually used in pain research to work out how the body and mind, or to unpick the processes between what we call body and mind, to work out where the triggers are, or what is controllable in terms of how pain is triggered and how its process continues. In working with illusions, I started to do scientific research in the background of illusions, and all of the research that I found were in two places, one through pain research and one through artificial intelligence. Mm. And I found that I really wanted to research it through chronic pain, because there is an approach that is looking at the biological, the psychological and the social through pain research, where neuroscientists are looking at all those three influences on pain as non-separable, really, that the biological is influenced by psychological and social relationships, and and vice versa for all of those.
Yes, and certainly in pain research, and I'll come back to Lorimer on this in a moment, but you can actually, if you get someone to experience a bodily illusion of some sort, that they might be occupying another body or an illusory hand might actually be their own even though it's not, you can change someone's experience of pain. But your work with illusions does all sorts of wacky things. You have people experiencing bodily illusions where they have a limb of theirs becomes a plant limb, or they become another species through the experience of an illusion. Extraordinary. What are you playing with there?
Well, I'm playing with, I guess there's a few things going on, and one is that there's the effect of experiencing the body of another human. You start to get a kind of empathy is triggered, which one of the scientists in artificial intelligence researchers, Mel Slater, on the effect of empathy through that process. So you can kind of experience sensations that are not there, but also that has an emotional roll-on effect that grows and is evidence in the way that they take information before and after the tests. And I'm interested in that emotional effect from illusions and sensations.
Yes,
and so people, and that capacity is so broad that people can also experience the sensations of being another species. And I'm interested in terms of nature, I'm interested in the pleasure that we gain from being in nature and our interactions with plants or in green environments and things like that as a counterpoint to our experiences of pain or other kinds of emotional pain as well.
Yes, I mean, you can actually, if you occupy another person's race, for example, a race that's different to your own through the virtue experience of a bodily illusion, that can change your racial bias. Lorimer Moseley, illusions are of great interest to pain researchers, aren't they?
They're of huge interest to us. I think, and a solid foundation on understanding that is to try and grasp what we think is reality, and that is that everything we feel in our body is effectively an illusion that's created by our brain in order to achieve some sort of behavioural outcome. And pain is no exception to that. So every single pain you've ever had is constructed by your brain. And it's easy to get sucked into the 400-year-old idea that that's only a one-way street, that the body informs the brain and the brain creates a feeling. That clearly happens, but those illusory studies, so some of the ones you referred to, Natasha, are just astoundingly important studies, I think, because they show quite clearly that if we can do something like an illusion to create a feeling in your body, then your body actually changes in some way to try to match that feeling, if you like. And
yeah, so
that's quite astounding.
It can actually reduce pain. I mean, people who have phantom limb pain where it feels like the pain is coming from the limb that's been missing through an amputation, you can actually, if you create a mirror situation where you place a mirror where the missing limb is so that it reflects the intact limb, the pain can go.
Yeah, it can go. I mean, it's always in the whispering in the back of my mind, Natasha, is everyone out there with phantom limb pain that hears that will not have a miraculous response to something like mirror therapy, but some do, and most have some response. But there's a famous episode of the TV show House where he kidnaps an amputee and then they wake up in front of a mirror and their phantom limb pain's healed, and it's not like that. But we do have clear, across the population of people with phantom limb pain, there's a reduction in pain with something like mirror therapy. But we can use that principle applied to people who are not amputees. We've done similar work with people with very painful hands, and we give them an illusion of their hand looking different, and their hand starts to behave differently and feel differently. And you know, it's quite, you know, there really are aha moments for people in pain, in part to prove that although this is a brutal pain, it's not indicative of a brutal injury necessarily. And that disconnect is a really hard one to get a handle on. But when you get a handle on it, it's a very empowering one for people in pain. And illusions help us not only understand, but help us treat. well, in that way.
We're running out of time, but I'd really keen to get a sense from Eugenie and Kat. In doing this residency, and I know, Eugenie, you're now an ambassador for Pelvic Pain Foundation of Australia, and indeed you decided to have a hysterectomy last year, and your experience of pain has fundamentally changed. And I wonder if that means you think your art will change.
I believe so. I didn't think it would, but yes, it will change, because my understanding of pain is much different. But at the same time, surprisingly enough, even after nearly 20 years of pain experience, I started to forget what kind of pain I was going through. But there are certain areas that I would never forget, especially the psychological experience that I was going through. That part I would never forget. But if somebody asked me, like, from 0 to 10, what was your pain before and what do you think it was before, I wouldn't be able to really pinpoint exactly where. I would start looking into interviewing patients, pain patients, and combine their stories and with the scientific knowledge and create artworks.
Kat Jones, what about yourself? Where are you taking this relationship?
Yeah, I think my artwork is in a process of quite large change in terms of what I've been able to study through this residency. And I'm using more and more, I'm really interested in this technique of how sensation can create emotion and meaning. So we don't necessarily even have to use words in order to, or didactic pictures even, in order to have an emotional response within an art context. So, okay.
Well, look, it's really interesting work, and I'd love to talk so much further about it. What an interesting collaboration between the three of you. Artists Eugenie Lee, Kat Jones, thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
Thanks.
And Professor Lorimer Moseley, Head of the Body and Mind Research Group at the University of South Australia, thank you.
Thanks, Natasha.
And details of what's happening through the Art of Pain exhibition in Adelaide this week, including details about the Australian Network of Art and Technology, all there on the Life Matters website. Up next, music and misadventure. Where does salsa, sharpie dancing, whirling dervishes and a pagan goat festival come together? In my next guest's life, Jane Cornwell is a music journalist, critic, writer, wanderer, and as you'll hear, her story begins in the Melbourne burbs, where I'm wondering if she ever could have imagined the adventures that life would take her on, lured by a love of music, a love of men too, as you'll hear. Her new memoir is called The Whirl, Men, Music and Misadventures, and she joined me on the line from London just a little earlier.
Hello, Natasha, how are you?
The misadventures, the men and the music. I mean, you know, what a life. You know, interestingly, Kathy Lett describes this story that you tell as voyeuristic bliss and a risque romp. And I think, like Kathy Lett, very few women put their sexual adventures out there as writers.
To be honest, I don't even know how sexual this is. I mean, I think these are a series of vignettes about men. So it's 18 chapters each with a man's name and a song title, and they're like portals to other worlds, really. You know, I think the sexy thing is slightly a bit of a misnomer. You know, there is some sex in certain chapters, but
the men that you meet along the way are a lens into the culture that you're landing in, the music genre that you're embracing in that chapter.
Sure, and I trained as an anthropologist before I became a journalist, so I'm always very interested in ritual and subculture. So we go from the acid house scene in the 80s, you know, in London, the club scene, which is a subculture in itself, to Santeria, which is the Afro-Cuban religion that I did a ritual into, to all sorts of things. And I mean, everything is a subculture, and everything, you know, I like to think everybody's life is soundtracked by music. This is what people can really relate to, and certainly when I've put a song title at the top of a chapter, I think that really helps people relate, you know, because it could be something like You Shook Me All Night Long, or, you know, all these different things that, you know, not too obscure, really.
So take us back to to your own exotic beginnings?
My exotic beginnings in Moorabbin?
Yeah, suburban Melbourne. Describe your childhood, but also the early musical encounters that really left an imprint on you. There was one in suburban Moorabbin that just blew you away.
Well, yes, indeed. I mean, I was the eldest, so I didn't have older brothers and sisters to point me in the direction of, you know, Captain Beefheart or Tim Buckley or anything like that. You know, this is in the 70s. I was just a curious kid that I would go down and to Eastland, which was the shopping centre, each Friday, and I would find some music for myself with my allowance. I would buy a cassette. So I would just flick through and choose things at random from Brash's record store, and I got everything from Tangerine Dream to Phoebe Snow and Keith Jarrett, you know, the jazz pianist. So really random choices for a young kid. But one day, because I grew up on riding horses and imagining, you know, travelling all over the world, and as I was going up the firebreak of Mount Dandenong, you know, on the back of my horse.
Yeah.
But one day in Brash's, I was flicking through and I found an album called Horses, with a picture of this dark-haired woman on the front with a, you know, flyaway collar, white shirt, and a black blazer over her shoulder, and a kind of yeah, what of it look on her face.
Yeah.
And I just took it home and played it, and of course it was Patti Smith.
The great Patti Smith. And that album was just...
It was just astounding.
Astounding.
You know, really, really amazing. And of course I didn't understand the lyrics. You know, I didn't know that Rambo wasn't R-A-M-B-O, it was the poet, you know, Rimbaud, and all this kind of stuff, and that some of the lyrics were about addiction, and, you know, but I would play this album over and over about, you know, white shining silver horses with their tails in flames and imagine them coming down the mountain. And it really, really took me away. And as I got older, I ended up having a tattoo of a silver horse with its tail in flames and on my back, and not very well done, but, you know.
And it's interesting, her album Horses is now 40 years.
That's right.
This year. And yeah, so describe, right. Because what followed in your life after your anthropology degree was a life of adventure. What wild horses did Patti unleash in you?
I wonder.
Just
if,
a bit cliched.
It is. It's funny, isn't it? Because it's sort of 20/20 hindsight. And I don't, you know. Well, I worked at The Last Laugh. I was at university and I worked at a comedy venue in inner city Melbourne called The Last Laugh, which many people will remember. It was the place to be, really, in inner city Melbourne in the 80s. And I met a stand-up comedian and just decided on a whim, really, after a few weeks romance to go and live with him in London. So it was just that thing of wanting adventure,
yeah.
I think.
He was a character. I mean, he was only 27 and yet he wanted to be dead by the time
He decided he was going to be dead by the time he was 30. He was sort of, he was a guy who loved Hemingway and Kerouac and all that sort of boy's own adventure stuff, well, with a kind of death wish, really. An adrenaline junkie, I guess, you know, and his whole kind of stand-up comedy was based on being an adrenaline junkie. He's still around, of course, you know. I saw him from a distance at Notting Hill Carnival and, you know, I saw that he's got grown fat and, you know, still alive.
His death mission didn't come to fruition. So he's the beginning, really, of this adventure.
I decided I would write a chapter about me, you know, my background, and then really the springboard was meeting this comic and heading off to London. So then when we broke up, I had to try and decide what I was going to do. I went off to Jamaica to make that decision and then stayed and got a job at the Institute of Contemporary Arts in central London, and then became a music writer and got a job working with world music.
You've been reporting on some of the greats, and throughout this whole memoir, just in between meeting, you know, everyday men and having flings with them in extraordinary locations, you're interviewing some real star characters like Cher and David Lynch and Axl Rose. But tell us about Achilles. Let's start this adventure beyond London, beyond Moorabbin. Achilles is, you meet him on a remote island off Greece, and what are you there for?
I went to cover the Goat Festival, which is I went really for a holiday to Skyros, which is the island, and it's the sort of New Age centre. They have various drama courses and this and that, but at this time I went while the Goat Festival was on, and this is a very bacchanalian pagan festival that goes way back and to sort of the mists of time, and it's about men dressing up as goats, basically. So they would wear the skin or the carcasses of baby of kids, you know, baby goats, and they cover themselves in bells, and it's It's a ritual. It's all about chanting and jumping with the bells and getting, and basically getting as drunk as possible, because there's a sort of philosophy that this will bring you closer to God. You know, the drunker you get, the closer you get to the heavens. Basically.
And Achilles was something of a...
And he was extremely good-looking young barman, yes, whose name was indeed Achilles. And, well, all these names had changed, but it was something like that. It was something as...
Mythological.
Indeed, yeah. And he was just a sweetie, really. But unfortunately, you know, I got into a situation at that time, you know, with another of the women there, who was... So I ended up being in kind of competition with him. So I write about being in competition for him, rather, with this other woman, and I sort of put it as Helen of Troy, and you know,
the things we do.
Yeah, we're kind of in competition, basically, and that did happen. I mean, often I will veer off into fiction with various things, but the bare bones are kind of true. But you know, it's quite a spectacle when you've got the whole community dressed up as goats, and it goes for a week, and it's all very... It's a bit like The Wicker Man. You know, you expect to see Edward Woodward trapped in a giant burning effigy or something at some point. You know,
Jane Cornwell is with us. She's a music writer and critic. She started life in Muralbark in suburban Melbourne. She's since travelled the world, reporting, living, loving music in every context and culture. Her new memoir is called The Whirl: Men, Music and Misadventures. And it's interesting that you do have an anthropology degree, because this kind of interconnection between world music and ritual and spirituality is a very powerful interest of yours. So take us to Turkey and to those whirling dervishes.
Well, I mean, that's an interesting one. Certainly, because I think, given the current climate, I mean, you know, because there are serious elements, obviously, to this book, and I think that what is overlooked is Sufism is a branch of Islam that's very, very peace-loving and celebrates art and dance and music and painting. And I mean, I go to Morocco as well, so I go to the Essaouira Festival, where there's the Ganawa musicians, and they're one form of Sufis. And then we, back in Turkey, the whirling dervishes is another branch of Sufi Islam, basically. Mm-hmm. So everyone will know the scene, a picture of the whirling dervishes, and there are these men, mainly men, that will dress in these conical hats and with capes, and they will assemble in these dervish lodges called tekkes, and they will start to whirl, and they will whirl with one arm facing down towards the ground, the other arm facing up towards heaven, and it's all about the spiral, and it's and the planets, and it's incredibly mystical, and it's very about connecting with yourself and connecting with God.
This incredible embodiment of something bigger.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's very beautiful and very mesmeric to watch. And I decided I wanted to try it myself.
Is that allowed?
But of course, no, it's not really. I mean, actually, there's a musician called Merchan Dede who is quite progressive from Istanbul. And he has a female whirling dervish. He's a club DJ as well, but he has a female whirling dervish who, when he's on, they'll turn the lights out and she whirls, and the bottom of her skirt lights up in neon. It looks incredible. Mm. But I was in a place called Konya, which is very conservative, so I just whirled in the privacy of my own hotel room. I found that very, very strengthening, basically.
It's not the first time.
I fell over, of course.
And of course you met Jean-Paul, and that, I thought that was incredibly fearless, just an encounter with a man in Turkey, as is not uncommon. But dance features in this book and in your life, because, of course, there's your relationship with Cuba and salsa, sexy salsa.
Well, yeah. I mean, I first actually went to Cuba when I was still living in Australia in about 1987, when there was no tourism. But
What captivated you about Cuba? So many people are drawn to Cuba, and of course, is on the cusp of massive change now. Obama.
I mean, that will be interesting to see whether it
opened up relations.
Take. Yeah, I don't think it will happen overnight, actually. But what drew me to Cuba? Well, the music. I mean, I absolutely adore the music. I mean, if I was going to put on a CD, I would probably put on a Cuban CD, because I love rumba, I love salsa, I love all the different forms of music that come out of there, and it's just so rich. But the culture is incredible, and I think, I mean, it's a kind of a cliche, but you know, the people there really do have absolutely nothing, but they are so upbeat and so good-natured, and you know, I've been there for Carnival and it's just no one can party like the Cubans. It really is wonderful. And of course, you know, with that combination of sun and dance and rum and gorgeous men and gorgeous, everybody's gorgeous, one thing leads to another and then, ay caramba.
Yeah. And you write a lovely line in the memoir, maybe I'd lived my life in dance steps.
Well, that's right. I mean, when I was writing this, I remember, you know, my agent or publisher said, well, where's the arc? And I thought, you know, there's nothing so, I mean, I don't think any woman's life has a tidy arc. You know, that's just not how a lot of us live our lives these days. We keep making the same mistakes. And that's why I sort of talk about this thing of the spiral. I mean, in fact, that's why I called the book The Whirl, because we all bumble around trying to work out where we're going in our lives and you know, we date the same kind of guys over and over and then maybe finally we'll kind of go, oh, this isn't working. But, mm-hmm. you know, in my case, I had to be walloped over the head, you know, a few times before I kind of realised that this wasn't really, good for me. But, you know, so in dance steps, yeah, I just thought that was a kind of nice analogy because it is like a cha-cha, you know, where sort of we go forward, backwards, sideways, you know, one step forward, two steps back, that kind of thing. I think that's common for most of us, really.
But what I get the sense of is that you're just incredibly open to experiences and to connecting with other people. And certainly not all of us have a fairly dandy chap waiting on a bridge in Paris for us.
Well, he's
Christophe, with his great
Christophe
sense of dress.
Yeah, I mean, he's a sapeur, a Congolese sapeur, and the sapeurs of the Congo are these incredibly well-dressed, almost dandies, who kind of, well, not worship, but they really revere designer labels. So Yves Saint Laurent, Yohji Yamamoto, they will dress in the most incredible way, but they will meet in a tin shack next to a sewer, you know, to talk about getting the dimple in their cravat just right. But it is a real phenomenon. But, you know, their history is to sort of put two fingers up to Mobutu, who was into sort of making everyone wear a uniform and, you know, the dictator. And there's just lots of history, and I'm just so interested in all this stuff. And, I mean, this is a guy who is a sapeur, who dresses beautifully, but he's also a refugee, and I really wanted to look at the other side of Paris, the African Paris, where there are people there that have got there through incredible hardship and that aren't really seen. You know, these are the guys you would walk straight past maybe when you're off to the Champs-Élysées or, you know, whatever, but they all have stories, and certainly with Christophe, he'd come from the Congo, which is riven with strife and war and all sorts, and was really struggling. The clothes he wore gave him a kind of outlet and made him feel, gave him a sense of pride.
Yes.
You know? And he was, yeah, he would meet me on the Pont des Arts, which is this wooden bridge that people must know with the little locks, you know, that the lovers put on there, and he would always bring me a little gift, and he's still a friend, you know, but I would text him, and he would just never text me back, you know, but when I would say, I'm coming to Paris, he would meet me on the bridge, so it became a little ritual itself.
It's 25 or more years now since you left Australia. Do you still feel a connection to that Merle Bark girl, the you know, breaking into the occasional Sharpie dance, perhaps?
Yeah. I'm not the occasional Sharpie dance. No, look, I have the same group of friends. Well, I could. I have the same group of friends that I've always had, you know, from school. I go back to Australia every year for WOM Adelaide. I do a bit of work for Peter Gabriel and go down for WOM Ad and stuff. And, you know, my mum's out in Montrose. My brother is in Montrose. My sister's in Olinda. And I love nothing more than going down to Chernside Park and hanging out. And I get my hair done at the local salon in Moorabbin. And, love it.
It's a great life in music. Jane Cornwell, thank you so much for joining us on Life Matters.
My pleasure.
And taking us on that whirl. Terrific to have you on.
Thank you. Suddenly, Johnny gets a feeling
he's been surrounded by horses, horses. Yes, it all started for Jane Cornwell in the Melbourne suburb of Moorabbin, listening to Patti Smith in the 1970s. Perhaps you remember that very year with that very album, Patti Smith and Horses. The book, The Whirl, Men, Music and Misadventures, published by HarperCollins, and that's where we have to leave you today. See ya.